You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
John Jay, one of the authors of the Federalist Papers advocating ratification of the U.S. Constitution, was fond of saying, "Those who own the country ought to govern it." Despite 200 years of extending the vote, civil rights struggles, and efforts to engage voters, Jay may actually be getting his wish. In a new book, John Nichols, The Nation magazine's Washington correspondent, and University of Illinois professor Robert McChesney examine the damage money and media are inflicting on American democracy. They have called it dollarocracy, how the money and media election complex is destroying America, and Nation Books is publishing. I'm very pleased that it has brought John Nichols back to our show. Hi.
I'm honored to be with you.
You say that the current situation is less democracy, more dollarocracy. Why call it dollarocracy as opposed to plutocracy or oligarchy?
I'm a Midwestern American. We dumb our language down a little, perhaps. And it's very funny that you bring that up. Bob McChesney, my co-author, and I were literally talking about this the other day because I had been at an event with Senator Bernie Sanders, and he closed his speech off by saying, "We're becoming a plutocracy." And Bob said he really should have said dollarocracy. And point being, Bob's one of the smartest people I know. He's very big intellectually. He had just come back from Scandinavia. It's not like he's not conscious of this. But I think sometimes our language is a language of sort of reasoned discourse, if you will, which I certainly respect. But we're talking about something very fundamental here. We're talking about people buying our government. And we ought to use the term of art. It's dollars. That's what's doing it.
The Economist Democracy Index ranked the United States below Uruguay, the Czech Republic, and Ireland. Do you think that the American political system could slip into becoming a flawed democracy?
Absolutely. In fact, we use the Economist Index, because the Economist is hardly a great left-wing publication. We also use Freedom House's measures and all sorts of other groupings to look at where the U.S. is ranked by folks who basically are inclined to be sympathetic to the U.S. And what we found is that on the Economist measure, their flawed democracy line, somewhat flawed democracy, is an 8 out of 10 scale. We're at 8.1. We have fallen steadily down to the edge of it. And the reason we have done so is not just money and politics. I want to emphasize, our book isn't just about money and politics. It's this fundamental issue of a collapse of the structures into a place where money is so powerful. Less media, less of, I think, a lot of the structural integrity of our politics. So at the end of the day, those ads, all of those ads that come flowing in, are far more influential than they would have been 20 years ago.
Recalling Mitt Romney's comments about corporations being persons and about the 47%, do you think that when some people talk about meritocracy, they're really talking about elite privilege?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, the fact of the matter is that in a democracy, we want to have a sense of where the great mass of people are. We want to protect basic rights within that. You can't say, oh, we're going to just go with whatever the mood of the moment is. But you can have a governance that is reflective of the needs of the great mass of people, and not to assume that those at the top got there solely by their intellect or by their hard work. The fact of the matter is that in our politics today, I mean, if you take a look at the U.S. Senate, and I do it a lot, one of the things that's pointed out to me again and again is that most of the people in our U.S. Senate are very wealthy. Now, some of them became wealthy since they got there.
In both parties.
And, do you know, this is a subtlety to it. I don't think that they're all bad people or anything like that. But I do think experientially they're a little out of touch with that simple reality of trying to balance a checkbook at the end of a month when you just don't have enough money coming in. And it's why we have a minimum wage in this country that is microscopic compared to what we would need to live above the poverty level.
And yet people reelect their members of Congress again and again. So approval, it's interesting. Approval ratings for Congress hovered just about 10%, and 56% of the American public surveyed believes that that their senator will sell them out for a campaign contribution, and yet they reelect these guys.
Well, I think that this gets to a deeper problem in American politics, and that is a sense of a lack of choice. You and I deal in political discourse all the time. And so we see the subtleties and we talk about it as the most important election. Every election in my lifetime has been the most important election of my lifetime. It's been described as such. But the fact of the matter is that the great mass of Americans, if you look at polling, see remarkably limited choices. And look at how excited people have gotten in New York City at the Bill de Blasio candidacy. Bill de Blasio, ideologically, on economic issues, is not all that different from Abe Beame. You know, he's not a radical. And yet, because he's literally said, I might tax some wealthy people a little more, people are just, that's amazing.
Not only that, they call him the far left candidate.
I know. And that speaks not about Bill de Blasio. That speaks about how narrow our political choices have become. And in a narrow circumstance, the status quo wins.
Now, your subtitle has the phrase, the money and media election complex. Do you see journalists at major news organizations as being members of the 1% themselves?
Some are. But that's not really what we're talking about so much as media as a entity unto itself that is a money-making, a profit-making institution by and large. Happens not at this station, but in an awful lot.
But we do want listener support.
As much as you can get, especially at pledge drive time. But the fact of the matter is that what we're talking about there is something much more nefarious, and that is that a class of consultants and ad salespeople for commercial television stations now sustain a system where so much money flows to commercial television stations via this money and media election complex that they're actually shaving minutes off the newscast, which should tell us about politics, to fit in more ads. And that's a very dangerous thing for a society where if we have money in politics, which we always have, back to the founding.
Although we had a new record last campaign. How much money was spent?
We say, and this is new research for the book, that it was $10 billion.
Yeah, now Open Secrets says it was $8 billion
or six
billion.
Yeah. And Open Secrets is fantastic. We are huge fans of them. We base our work off them. But do you know why? And by the way, that was the headline. You may have reported it on your show back in November. This was a $6 billion election. We should be very concerned. Well, but they look at federal elections. On that election day last year, we had local and state elections as well as referendums. Do you know that in California alone, more than $500 million was spent last year on referendums? And so we found local races where the same billionaires that are moving money into presidential politics are moving monies into county commission and city council elections.
And we just saw a lot of money spent on these recall elections in Colorado.
And millions coming in through independent groupings in New York City.
And by the way, in both cases, few people actually voting despite all of that.
Well, this is what we mean about dollarocracy. When you develop a circumstance where citizens begin to doubt whether their vote matters all that much and where the money becomes such a dominant reality, we end up in a circumstance where what politicians will naturally respond to is the dollar, not the vote.
Well, I was more concerned, very concerned about Freedom House's 2013 Press Freedom Index, which ranks the United States 23rd in the world behind Estonia, Portugal, and Marshall Islands. Mm-hmm. What does that mean, press freedom? Mm-hmm. Is the press not free? I thought our press was doing pretty well in exposing all sorts of things that the government would prefer it not to write about.
And people do. People do great work every day, and I'm a part of this community, and so I'm very tonight I'll appear with my friend Jeremy Scahill, who I think has done incredible work, and others. But I do want to emphasize that one of the biggest problems we have now is that while we occasionally can get a good story out any place, what doesn't happen is a good broad discourse. We look at the difference between the early 1970s when we had fewer media outlets, but when a Pentagon Papers story came, that riveted the country. We don't have circumstances like that, partially because we have so dumbed down our press, and also we are literally shutting down our press in America. We write about this extensively in the book. Daily newspapers closing, radio and television stations laying off huge numbers of employees, literally fewer journalists covering our state and local races. We detail in the book several circumstances where someone was nominated for a major office, lieutenant governor, U.S. senator, where there had been virtually no reporting on the primary, and then after after the person was nominated, papers finally catch up and they say, oh my gosh, we've nominated somebody with huge fundamental flaws. Well, you understand, that is a failure of the press, which leads to a denial of democracy. If one of your two candidates is fundamentally flawed, so flawed that the people just aren't going to vote for him, you've created a circumstance by where a failure to cover the process when it mattered ends up making the process not matter. And that's a dangerous game. And that's where we think our press has fallen down in a lot of ways.
Well, many people complain about the horse race approach to reporting political campaigns. And that starts with at the very beginnings, doesn't it?
Oh, it's a nightmare.
So-and-so is ahead and somebody else.
Because they can raise money. Let me give you a scenario of how if we took 3 years, we looked at two election cycles and we really stepped back and we said, forget everything we know. Let's look at how American politics operates today. Because we really wanted to understand all the inputs. Here's what we found is, of course, money's there. You know, we know about that. But what's fascinating, especially in this Citizens United area, is that there's so much more money coming from so many different directions. And what our press too often does is do a money primary initially, say you're viable because you can raise money. Then when you get into the process, what they do, amazingly enough, immense amounts of our press reports on the ads. They literally say, well, here's this new ad. And they don't just report on its content. They will also say, well, this may be effective in this way. And so we have delinked a lot of our politics from who the candidates really are, who the parties really are, and what the people are really concerned about.
Kurt Anderson and I moderated a panel discussion. Not a panel discussion. We talked to each one of the mayoral candidates, other than Anthony Weiner, who didn't show, about the support of the arts. And the next day, the New York Times did not mention it, even though everyone was there, Christine Quinn, mm-hmm. Bill mm-hmm. de Blasio, Bill Thompson, et cetera. What they mentioned instead was that Anthony Weiner had some kind of campaign stop where very few people showed up.
I know. It's just the trivialization of our politics is so nightmarish, and it ought to be something that we're screaming about. And you know, one of the things we detail in the book, we bring in a lot of international work. It isn't like this every place else. Do you know in Norway, they just had elections, and they've had a change of government. These are real meaningful elections, whether you like them or not. But what's interesting is they don't allow TV ads in Norway. Do you know why? They bluntly say, well, that's propaganda. You couldn't – in something so important as an election, you can't reduce it to 30-second spots and trivia. We're deciding who runs the country or who runs the city.
Japan also bans them.
Yeah.
Is political advertising being used differently today than it was in the past? Was the Daisy commercial something of a turning point?
The Daisy commercial is definitional for the modern era. The Daisy commercial, bizarrely enough, would not be today seen. Our listeners should know, and I know your listeners are so smart. The Daisy commercial was, of course, the Lyndon Johnson campaign ad suggesting that Barry Goldwater might lead us to nuclear war. It ran one time. It was so influential, had a huge impact on the campaign. But when you look back at that ad, comparing to what we see now, the negativism of our ads is dominant. And this is an important thing. We study this in the book. Again, journalism has stepped off the playing field often, so the ads become what people learn about our politics. And yet in some U.S. Senate races last year, more than 95% of the ads were negative. Nobody came out and said, here's what I want to do. Everybody came out and said, my opponent is awful. And we wonder why in critical elections, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80% of our people don't vote. It's because they literally have been inundated with a message that both candidates or all candidates are awful.
In the United States, spending money on advertising or whatever is now taken to be protected speech.
Here's the big problem with this. And we say it bluntly. Money is not speech. Corporations are not people. And the citizens of this country have a right, have an absolute right, even if their Supreme Court disagrees with them, to amend the Constitution of the United States to say that we, the people, as Teddy Roosevelt proposed, have a right to regulate the role of corporations in our politics. Period. Say that bluntly without apology.
My guest is John Nichols, Nation Magazine's Washington, D.C. correspondent. He and Robert W. McChesney, who is the Gutzgesell. How do you pronounce
it? It's Gutzgesell.
Gutzgesell, endowed professor of the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, have co-authored a book called Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. It has a foreword by Senator Bernie Sanders, and it's published by Nation Books. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with John Nichols, who is co-author with Robert W. McChesney of Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. It's published by Nation Books. When George Washington was elected president in 1789, only propertied white men could vote, about 6% of the population. Was the United States a plutocracy or a dollarocracy then?
Yes, no doubt about that. We had a circumstance in the United States, much like Britain, the country we had just revolted against, where our elections really were not elections in any sense that we would understand today. They were more a gathering of property holders, sometimes in a large room where they would vote, but most of the people people of color, white folks who didn't have money or didn't have property were outside. Sometimes they would actually, amazingly enough, it was a spectator sport. People would gather outside to see what the rich guys would do. What I would suggest to you is we're getting closer to that again than we would want to be.
And how did that ever happen? I mean, we've just gone through the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. Earlier, of course, women finally given the vote. You would have thought we were moving inexorably in a different direction.
Eric Foner, the great historian, says that the best way to understand, and we write about this in the book, the best way to understand the vote, and the vote is a big part of our book, is to recognize that it's always fits and starts. And somebody is always trying to figure out how to count the vote in their favor. And often that has to do with narrowing the electorate rather than expanding it. We talk a lot about voter suppression. But I would suggest that we ought to expand our definition of voter suppression and understand that negative advertising is a form of voter suppression. It's encouraging people not to vote. You know, don't vote for the candidate you like because really it's a horrible person. So too is a lack of media coverage. When you don't tell people about elections, when you don't give a full character of it, again, these are things that cause people to not vote. And we have a crisis of not voting in America.
You say that there's a growing distance between what politicians and pundits say and the actual problems that are being experienced by most Americans. What are politicians doing and what are they missing or ignoring?
Well, politicians live in a world of rarefied environments where they travel in limousines from one event to another. They drink bottled water. They go into the same suites that the CEOs go into. Some politicians are drawn out of that world for a few hours to go and shake hands on a street, get a picture taken. But the fact of the matter is, and we interview many senators, and there's a lot of good people in politics who are very, very frustrated with the game that it has become. But I remember, and I won't say his name per se, although I don't know that he'd mind. The fact of the matter is I was covering a Senate candidate in 2006, and I had known him for many years. I'd covered him. And usually I would ride in the car when you're going from stop to stop to interview. And the candidate said, you can't ride in the car because when I'm in the car now for these long stops, you're going to have to follow because I've got to do fundraising calls the whole time. And he didn't like that, but that is what we have reduced good and bad players in politics to.
One of the striking details you mentioned is that our elected representatives tend to vote against the needs of the bottom third of their constituents, the ones who are least well off. Is that the kind of point that was made by Thomas Frank in What's the Matter with Kansas, that some of the worst off voters are electing politicians who are least likely to support their needs?
Well, you're kind of going into two zones here, and Frank is – you're right to bring up Frank. But what Frank was talking about was this idea that a broader idea that I think is very vital here, and that is that because the parties don't talk about much in the area of economics, we end up having our debates about social issues, and that is abortion, marriage equality, gun issues, all very, very important issues, vital issues. But if you've taken economics off the table, it becomes much easier for economic elites to shape a debate that is always advantageous to them, that real change never comes in the zone that matters to them. It may come on marriage equality. Fantastic. Great progress there. But when you're churning particularly folks and folks who might be more socially conservative to come out and vote based on social issues, never to think about economics because never to imagine that their vote could matter.
But when we talk about economics, many people agree that it was the easing up of regulation that led to the current economic situation. And yet, when anybody suggests any new regulations. The debate is structured in such a way as to make it sound like the government is once again getting into our lives.
Well, and you see, this is really the triumph of spin. And here's a fascinating fact for you, or at least for me. In 1980, when Ronald Reagan became president, we had a one-on-one ratio of PR people to members of Congress, you know, in Washington. We now have a 4-to-1 ratio, and it's
rising. One-on-one is a lot.
One-on-one's a lot, but you understand what I'm saying is our political world is flooded with spin, and spin has become so dominant that in a money and media election complex, it is literally able to define the issues, to frame the debate. And Leonard, it's so simple. If we don't have a debate about economic issues, right? If it is just if that's kind of off the table, yes, people will discuss other issues. But at the end of the day, you will find very poor folks voting against what would seem to be their own interests.
But you also mentioned what Paul Krugman calls the cult of balance, the tendency in the media to give two sides equal time, even when one is false.
Mm-hmm. No, it's a deeply frustrating reality. And again, what concerns us is not that somebody could be wrong. People can be wrong, and people have been wrong. What concerns us is that there are people who know they are wrong, but for their own economic interest, pour enough money into the political process so that their wrong ideas remain alive. Leonard, what we have today is zombie ideas, ideas that have been disproven, that have been rejected by the voters, that resurface again and again and walk among us. The ideas that somehow, for instance, there's going to be a trickle-down economics. That's an idea tried 30 years ago. It didn't work, and yet it's alive in our politics today. Why? Because some people who are very much advantaged by it pour immense amounts of money into the game.
Mayor Bloomberg said that we should be welcoming the Russian billionaires to New York because it'll lead to trickle-down economics.
Well, you know, the amazing thing is that that at the end of the day, you may get a little bit of trickle-down economics. You may. I understand that. But it doesn't trickle down to create a vibrant, rich, democratic, small-d democratic life. Because the fact of the matter is, when people are really struggling day to day to get by, they have a lot less time to go to a town meeting, to get engaged with their school board, to really seriously, you know, engage with the politics of a place. And it isn't because they don't care. You know what's fascinating about us? On the big issues, about this time, on the big issues where people know about it and where they've had some real experience, look what happens. President Obama proposes a military intervention in Syria. Everybody gets where we've been the last 10 years. And there's this massive public opposition. And many in the media still say, oh, well, the Americans are war weary. They're tired of war. That's an insulting concept. I disagree. I think the Americans are war wary. They have had 10 years of experience that tells them to ask tougher questions. And that goes up and down the economic ladder. And look at the impact. When people really are freed, and give President Obama his credit, when he went to Congress, that opened a space for debate. When people are freed to bring their skepticism, their ideas into the game, it is profound, and it can shape where this country is. The problem is we have too few instances where that can happen.
Why do you think so many people in the press have supported intervention in Syria, going back to Bill Keller, who used to run the New York Times, to Scott Simon here at NPR, to Christiane Amanpour? There are people all over the press who we wouldn't normally think of as warmongers.
No, and who, I don't think they necessarily
kind of,
are.
So is it because they've thought more deeply about this, or is it?
That's a very interesting question. I would argue that there are people who are very sincerely influenced by the notion that they have power, they have authority in our society, they can speak, and or even as a president, they can make things happen, and they should. But here's the interesting thing, Leonard, and we write about this a lot in the book. The founders of this American experiment said, and George Mason said when writing the Constitution, the purpose was to constrain rather than to facilitate war, i.e. that the whole idea is to slow things down and let the people get into the process, not just elite intellectuals, not just elite politicians, but to have something akin to a real discourse. I think we've moved way too far from that. And what we write about in this book is really a cry to let us return to moments where we can say, yes, we'll listen to those elite folks, But then let's have a real debate in this country.
My guest is John Nichols, who with Robert W. McChesney has written Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. It's published by Nation Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. There's a lot of debate among political scientists and economists about what all the campaign donations do. Do they buy votes, inform people and politicians, exclude candidates who don't have access to money? Some have suggested that the amounts spent are really pretty small given the wealth available.
It's a ridiculous concept, except that I will say they are small compared to what will be spent unless we intervene. The fact of the matter is we have exponential growth in spending, and that exponential growth in spending, you know, the problem is that so much of our media simply covers Washington. They cover national politics, and maybe they get to New York now and again, but they don't go across the whole of this country. And so the fact of the matter is that there were folks who said after the 2012 election, well, Obama beat Romney, so people power beat money power. No, when you look at the figures, in fact, Obama's money was just about equal to Romney's.
I think he raised a little more, in fact.
He did a little more in that, but the outside spending brought Romney up. And so Romney had a slight advantage overall, but the bottom line is big money beat big money. And the fact of the matter is that the real measure is not the individual or the party. The real measure is that frustration level of the American people, that sense that things just don't progress. Well, that's what money buys. Understand, when we have a country with a very wide income inequality, where we have some of the wealthiest people in the world, the status quo doesn't have to change. You know what I mean? In fact, the return on the investment is gridlock. It's gridlock works for a lot of very, very wealthy people.
It doesn't always get you the election. John Katsimatidis, despite his billions and a lot of money spent, got a very small number of votes. Mm-hmm. We've seen it with other wealthy people, John Huffington, for example.
Well, Mitt Romney.
Mitt Romney.
Yeah.
They outspent their opponents, personally anyway, and still lost.
We have a wonderful quote in the book from Sheldon Adelson, who spent about $200 million. And what we detail in the book is that while Adelson didn't do very well at the presidential level, he had a lot of impact in local and state races around the country. So he got return on his investment.
And the Koch brothers.
The Koch brothers do very well.
Also
at the state level,
especially. Proud of what they've done.
But here's the subtlety of it. Here's Adelson. I kind of like the way he talks about this stuff. He talks about it as a poker game. He says, yeah, sometimes you get a bad hand. But, you know, if you've got enough to ante up for the next hand, eventually you're going to get a winning hand. That's the way very wealthy people think about our politics.
Also, he also owns casinos, so maybe he thinks that way because of that.
Give him credit.
Congressman Reed Ribble of Wisconsin has said, we're at a place now in this country where voters are not picking their representatives anymore. Representatives, through the gerrymandering process and redistricting, are picking their voters. And he's a conservative Republican.
Oh, yeah.
Aren't
sure.
they the ones who have been doing most of the gerrymandering and redistricting recently?
Well, in conservative states, the fact of the matter is, look, both parties play this game. One of the things we say in the book is that if we're to be honest about political reform in this country, if we say we want to get money out of politics, that's a good thing. If we say we want to really revitalize our media and take the steps that are necessary to have a strong, independent community, public media in this country, all the things that we would like to do, we also have to recognize that there are a lot of structural flaws that have to be addressed. The fact of the matter is gerrymandering is a corruption of the process. The Electoral College is a ridiculous entity that allows somebody who loses the popular vote to become president. We have real need for reform in this country, and it ought to be broad, not narrow.
Doesn't federal law allow redistricting to favor incumbents?
Well, we had a series of court decisions back in the 60s that seemed to be moving us toward something better, and then we've fallen back. The truth, Leonard, is that when we did the research for this book, what we found is that as with almost every issue, money in politics, all of the questions of how we run our debates and all that, you have fits and starts. You may move toward a better circumstance, and then we move back. The fact of the matter is what we became very comfortable with in writing this book was there are times when we need to amend our Constitution. The founders are right. You can amend the Constitution to make the Republic better. And one of the things we should do, and I'll be very blunt, is amend the Constitution to bar gerrymandering, period. It's a simple step. And you know what? I've put that in front of conservative audiences and liberal audiences. I have found very little opposition to the idea.
Yeah, but an awful lot of people would like to get rid of the Electoral College
as well.
But that's not going to happen.
You know, brother, hey, do you know how close we – do you know that in the late 1960s, It made it through the House. It was moving through the Senate. Only some messing around by Richard Nixon saved the Electoral College. We have the important thing to understand. This is really important. Many times in the history of this republic, we've had big problems. In 1910, we didn't elect our senators. Women couldn't vote. We couldn't tax corporations in a functional way. By 1920, we elected our senators. Women could vote. We could tax corporations in a functional way. Three constitutional amendments, fundamental change. We should recognize that there are times where the Gilded Age has become enough of a problem that we the people ought to step up and make some changes.
You have dropped little criticisms about the Supreme Court throughout this conversation. But in the book, you're especially critical of two justices, Lewis Powell, mm-hmm. who served from 1972 to 1987, and the current Chief Justice John Roberts. Why Lewis Powell? There are all sorts of people.
Right? Yeah. Well, anybody
have gotten angry about.
If anybody doesn't know about Lewis Powell, they should. And it's probably some of the funnest, most interesting stuff in our book. Lewis Powell was a lawyer from Virginia. Who was very knew a lot of the tobacco industry. When they banned tobacco ads on TV at the late 60s, early 70s, Lewis Powell essentially wrote a memo to corporations saying, you know what? They're starting to regulate us. If we don't get more involved in politics, it's going to be a big problem. This Powell memo is a remarkable document because it really outlines a lot of what you see as the corporate infrastructure politically that has developed. And then, amazingly enough, Powell, who had said twice to Richard Nixon, I don't want to be on the Supreme Court, shortly after he wrote the memo, said, that's okay, you can put me on. He went on the court, and frankly, he wrote a series of decisions that were very beneficial to a money and politics circumstance. So we call the guy out and have some objections to him.
And the Roberts Court, of course, a number of things. The Bush presidency, then Citizens United ruling.
The Bush presidency was pre-Roberts.
Oh, that was Rehnquist?
But it was heading that direction. Here's the critical thing about the Roberts Court. Justice Ginsburg says it's an activist court, essentially, and she's right. This is a court that – in the Citizens United case, which is well known, this is a case that allowed corporations to put a lot more money into politics. There is simply no question, and we detail in the book, how Chief Justice Roberts sought to expand that case. It was a relatively narrow case. He sought to make it much broader so the court could aggressively intervene. Since the Citizens United ruling, the court has again and again aggressively intervened on behalf of a vision of politics that happens to be very, very good for big corporations, for very wealthy people, but doesn't strike us as very good for democracy.
Well, there's been a lot of interest in American democracy and inequality in the last few years. Regularly we hear on news reports that the gap between rich and poor has widened now to the biggest gap since the 20s. There's a lot of research. You mentioned books like Winner Take All Politics, Unequal Democracy, Affluence and Influence. So the public is hearing about all of this. Why do you think it's having so little impact?
That's why we've written this fine new book, Dollarocracy.
is the book that's going to change
things.
No.
Well, here's our argument. Our argument is that too much of this discussion actually, not intentionally, those authors that you've mentioned are great and their books are great, but there's too much of a tendency to treat this as sort of an organic reality. We argue this is a very specific political reality resulting from a decline in media, a rise in money in politics, which creates an almost ideal situation to spin the fantasy that money in power, that the circumstances, the deregulations, the tax cuts for the very wealthy are somehow good for our economy. It's a false premise.
John Nichols is the Nation Magazine's Washington, D.C. correspondent. Robert W. McChesney, his co-author of a new book called Dollarocracy, is a professor in the Department of Communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And this book is subtitled How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. It's published by Nation Books. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
It has been such a pleasure. Thank you.